It's June 10th. I'm your regular host, Kevin Annett. We're back as always. Follow our work, murderbydecree.com, itccs.org, the International Tribunal of Crimes of Church and State. Well, folks, the times, they are a-changing. This last week, we found that the Pope, so-called Pope Francis, Jorge Bergoglio from Argentina, is considering canceling his appearance before the World Council of Churches on June 21st as a result of very large protests that are building in Geneva to confront him and the World Council of Churches' willingness to aid and abet a convicted war criminal like Bergoglio. This is directly the result of our work. In response to that, we're going to be airing a special program today, which I'll explain in a minute. But it's an interesting fact. If you notice in the news this last week, there's yet another so-called suicide death of somebody connected to Jorge Bergoglio. In this case, it's the sister of the Queen of Holland, Inez Zorguieta. Now, a little bit of explanation. Her sister, Maxima Zorguieta, is now the so-called Queen of the Netherlands. She's an Argentine citizen, and their family is very close to the present Pope, Jorge Bergoglio, because Bergoglio served with Maxima's dad, Jorge Zorguieta, when he was agriculture minister for the military junta in Argentina during the dirty wars in the 1980s. Well, the Pope helped Maxima Zorguieta clean up some bad stuff back in Argentina. He got her paperwork ready and cleaned her criminal past to help prepare her appearance as the Queen of Holland. So the family owes the Pope a lot. Well, what's interesting is the younger sister, Inez Zorguieta, is found dead of an apparent suicide. The police say we assume suicide, so obviously there was no autopsy done yet. And the 33-year-old young girl died on Wednesday night. Now, what's interesting is this is occurring right in the same week when Bergoglio has been exposed in the Swiss community as somebody who is connected to the Ninth Circle, which the Dutch royal family is closely connected to. Just after the Pope got appointed years ago, one of his nephews was found, yes, suicided in an Argentine apartment. Once again in Buenos Aires, a relative of the Pope is found dead, or a good friend of him. So is this a house cleaning by the Vatican? Is this getting rid of possible leaks to the Ninth Circle connection? Definitely the result of pressure being brought to bear. That's why he stepped down, possibly, from speaking on June 21st. So anyway, folks, this shows that the pressure works. The campaign continued by the ITCCS all over the world is having an effect. There is a Latin American office of the ITCCS formed now, directly doing work in Argentina, Chile, and Colombia to expose these crimes to the Vatican. And it's one of the reasons today we're going to air a program, kind of an exclusive interview between myself and Rachel Aird, an investigative journalist in Canada. Because this coming week is also an important anniversary. On Tuesday, June 12th, is the 20th anniversary of the opening of the first independent tribunal into crimes of genocide in Canada, the IRAM Tribunal in Vancouver, that I helped organize with a Native woman called Harriet Nahani. And Harriet, who was killed in a prison cell after that, and myself, brought together the first international jurists to look at the evidence of genocide in Indian residential schools run by the Catholic, Anglican, and United Churches. As a direct result of that campaign, all of this stuff began to come out, including the ITCCS formation and all of this exposure of Vatican crimes. So we think it's appropriate to air this interview today because, folks, this is an example how a grassroots movement from the bottom up can achieve miracles. Don't forget, none of our work has ever been supported by any official body, by a government grant, by some benefactor somewhere. It's all been community-led, grassroots-led, and look at what we've achieved. So it's important that we hold up these victories, the kind of victories that the powers that be do not want you to remember, because it's an example being set that, yes, we the people can not only bring about these results, but sit in judgment legally and lawfully of these people and bring down the churches and governments and corporations killing our children and causing all these horrendous historic crimes. So that's going to be our show. I hope you enjoy it. If you want to write to us, itccsoffice@gmail.com, murderbydecree.com, which is, again, back on site now. It was offline for several weeks after being attacked, but murderbydecree.com is back online, and it contains a lot of the original evidence from that tribunal in 1998, whose 20th anniversary we commemorate this week. So, hope you enjoy the show. Thank you, folks. We'll be back next week. Stay strong and stay clear.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to Diggers.
This is a stand-down order issued by the International Common Law Court of Justice and the Common Law Court of Canada Criminal Trial Division. The stand-down order is issued this day, June 1st, 2017, against the fiduciary officers, agents, and clergy of the following corporations: the Roman Catholic Church, the United Church of Canada, and the Anglican Church of Canada. You are hereby ordered to stand down and refrain from engaging in the collection of any monies for your corporation or from administering funds or properties of your corporation on the following grounds. 1. You represent convicted criminal bodies that have been found guilty under international law of genocide, child trafficking, and other crimes against humanity, and therefore have no legal right to operate or gather revenue. 2. You are defrauding Canada and its taxpayers by misrepresenting your corporations as lawful and charitable Christian societies, and thereby you are falsely claiming tax-exempt status under the Income Tax Act. And 3. You and your corporations have been ordered to cease and desist from your operations and to vacate your illegal occupation of Indigenous lands across Canada by duly registered court orders. If you fail to abide by this order, you can and will be arrested, charged, and tried in our common law courts as an accessory to a crime. Issued June 1st, 2017, by the Common Law Court of Canada.
And welcome to Radio Free Canada. I'm your host, Kevin Annett. Welcome back. It's July 16th, 2017. Yes, we are live again, as always, here on the territory of Canada. I begin today with the words from my ancestor, Peter Annett, from England, 1761, when he wrote, "We shall expose the hidden works of darkness and drive falsely to the bottomless pit." He was referring to the Church of England and the Crown of England, but we are continuing his work. 250 years later, the crime continues. And our struggle continues. Well, today is a memorable event for me. It's 25 years ago this week, that my young family and I went to the coastal town of Port Alberni, where the whole story, the whole saga began of exposing this crime of genocide in Canada. I'm going to mark this day by reflecting on some of the great lessons, victories, and other experiences we gained over the last 25 years, which have rocked Canada and the world. We have exposed Canadian institutions as genocidal. We have exposed their sponsors in Rome and London, forced one pope and three cardinals to resign, and established a new jurisdiction of the common law by which these criminal bodies can be put on trial and stopped forever. But that, of course, is up to you and me, we the people. There's no savior who's going to come in and do it for us, people. It's going to be us. And that's a constant theme on our show. Today I'm going to have as my guest Rachel Aird. She's a journalist from London, Ontario. She was actually on our show on June 18th, talking about the child trafficking and satanic networks in London, Ontario, one of the main areas of child trafficking and also human disappearances in Canada. We got into that. We're going to be touching on that again today, but I've asked Rachel to come on as a journalist to have a dialogue with me about how this whole story came about over 25 years, how it persisted, how we won in a very basic way in bringing this truth to light and helping countless people. She's going to be on in a minute. You know, I'm reminded as we talk about this that there's a saying from someone who I can't remember, but it's that all history is biography. You can't really understand history and where we've gotten without looking at the lives of the people involved. And I'm thinking 25 years ago now, I've actually got a picture in my hand, and there's a picture of me with my two young daughters on Long Beach near Tofino. We had just arrived that same week. My daughter Eleanor had been born on July 8th, so here's me holding a little week-old Eleanor in my arms, sitting with three-and-a-half-year-old daughter Claire on the beach. Their mom Ann was taking the picture, and we're all sitting there, and I was looking at that man and wondering, just, you know, how could I have been that naive? How could I have been that ignorant and complicit? I was 36, you know, happily married, happily assimilated, if you like, into the mindset of the culture, not aware of the fact that the church that I was working for, the United Church of Canada, had so much blood on its hands. Not able to yet look at the question of how is it that these Anglican, Catholic, and United churches, for over a century, systematically starved, raped, and murdered over 50 to 60,000 Aboriginal children, decade after decade, not as one incident, but decade after decade, without a qualm, business as usual. And then only were forced to address it only after they began to get sued in court, and after that, concealed the whole thing up and are now today carrying on like everything is fixed. It's really not a question of it being unjust, brothers and sisters. It's not a simple question of injustice or hypocrisy. It's sheer madness. The people responsible, whether at the top or at the lower levels, sitting there on Sunday today singing their nice hymns, contributing to these child trafficking and murderous institutions, they're crazy. They're dissociated. And that's another theme of our show. We have to recover our own minds, our sovereignty, or we'll continue to persist in that complicity. And for me, that picture sums it up. I didn't realize the extent of my complicity then because I was immersed in it. I've come out of that. And unfortunately, it's taken a lot of suffering and pain, but I think that's often the way it is. There's another nice quote I like, and that is, we're all born dead souls into this world. We only become alive as souls through suffering for what is right. And I think that that's really a statement of my life for the last 25 years. So I am thankful now for all of the suffering and all of the things thrown at me because it helped open my eyes and it's helped save many lives. So when next time you're tempted to feel, you know, oppressed by everything being thrown at you, you think you're alone, you think you're being targeted mercilessly and you're going to lose, it's part of your waking up. Because I don't think, you know, whether you call it God or the universe, I don't think creation wants us to be happy necessarily. I think creation wants us to wake up and not be complicit anymore. And this is the way it happens. So I'm really quite happy to be talking about this today with Rachel Laird. She'll be on any minute. But before that happens, I want to remind you that in the recent books we published, all of this can be, all the hard evidence can be viewed. Of course, the main work over 25 years, Murder by Decree, The Crime of Genocide in Canada, the hard evidence, the documentation, the eyewitness testimonies, all of the stuff that proves that genocide in Canada was deliberate and is still carrying on today, murderbydecree.com, you can read it online, order it at Amazon for $20. My recent book, Fallen, The Story of the Vancouver Four, also you can get that at Amazon. Just put in Kevin Annett, A-N-N-E-T-T. It tells the story of my four friends, Harry Wilson, Bingo Dawson, Ricky LaValle, and William Coombs, all of whom murdered by the church and government and RCMP for speaking out about these crimes, four of our fallen heroes in Vancouver. So you can get that online at Amazon as well for actually very cheap, between $10 and $20 for all of the books. And made it affordable so that you can get this into the schools, into the curriculum, so the next generation will not be complicit as we have all been. And finally, one of the things we're going to be talking to Rachel about today is the fact that the ongoing nature of these crimes, there's a continuity of crimes. The same people who were trafficking and harming those children are still doing it today. For example, the policies in Vancouver hospitals of do not resuscitate Native people when they're in a life and death situation. The BFA protocol, so-called baby for adoption protocol, where pregnant mothers, especially if they're Catholic, young mothers, are targeted to have their baby trafficked to foster care agencies and others by the Catholic Church and its Providence health care system in Vancouver. The fact that the Canada Revenue Agency is targeting anyone who's criticizing them. And this we have from insiders and other sources. The income tax people are targeting anyone who speaks out against the CRA as an offshore private corporation illegally getting money off Canadians. Now, this concerns all of you because you're paying the taxes. You're being ripped off. All of these policies carrying on today. And I was just speaking over the last few weeks to a fellow who was targeted for trafficking at a very young age, a Native guy from up in Prince Rupert. He just happened in his counseling to say that, you know, in frustration, he said, I'd like to just go after the guy who did this to me. That same hour, the RCMP showed up and incarcerated him in a mental institute because of the possibility that he might go after his child rapist, who was a very prominent man in Prince Rupert. And we're going to be talking about that story. So these are examples of how the crime is carrying on today. And so we're, you know, very conscious of that fact now. Now, I know Rachel is with us, so without further ado, we're going to go to her. Rachel, hello, welcome.
Hi, Kevin. How are you?
I am great. It's been a good 25 years.
Yes, it sounds like it has been.
Now, I was just giving the folks a little bit of an intro and asking that as a journalist and somebody who, in many ways, have had similar kinds of parallel experiences in her life, when you hear my story and you hear about all this truth, what are some of the questions you had just as a knowledgeable person, somebody who is concerned about crimes in their own backyard here in Canada?
Oh, sure. That's a great question. And before I answer, I just wanted to tell you it really is an honor and a privilege to be able to speak with you today to honor, you know, 25 years of this journey that you've been on. And I'm also really grateful that there's a radio show that creates this platform for people to speak, and, you know, grateful to the listeners that are listening today and, you know, on the recorded show in time as well.
Thank you.
So you asked just about my, you know, my thoughts as a journalist, and I just can share that what's really interesting where our paths crossed in the 90s was that right when, so in 1992 is when you moved to Port Alberni and where your story started. By 1998 and 1999, the rest of Canada started to pick up on the story and was posting it in the Globe and Mail and other news. So there was an event that you participated in. So it was February 1998, and that was reported in the news. It was, you know, you had 600 people that were in Vancouver for this public rally. And I read that article, and I thought, you know, something is really unique and radical about what this group is doing, and it it just really piqued my interest. Did you want to speak a little bit about, you know, maybe those beginning days, sort of how the story started for you in 1992, and how that sort of changed your course from what you thought might be happening when you moved there?
Well, I know, you know, the story's been told a lot, and people have seen Unrepentant in that. They know that getting there as a minister, naivety, I often say, you know, Rachel, naivety is an advantage sometimes, because if we were really aware of what we're walking into, no sane person would do it. You wouldn't walk in knowing you're going to lose your family, you're going to be blacklisted. And so in our ignorance, we can open the doors we wouldn't if we were more erudite people about the situation. And mm-hmm. That was definitely my case. I very naively, I thought, okay, we're supposed to be Christians here. I follow and love the words of Jesus. I'm going to open the doors. We're going to bring in the natives. And literally the first native who began talking to me mentioned about his best friend being beaten to death at the Alberni Residential School, run by my employer. And I remember when that happened to me, my first reaction was, can't be. I mean, I was raised in the United Church. We used to send care packages to Haiti. We used to work for the homeless. I mean, how can this have happened? But person after person told me, and I began to find documents and letters to confirm what they were saying. So my reaction, and I, in my whistleblower's manual, I say this is our normal reaction. You operate in the system. You go to somebody in authority in the church, and you tell them about it. That's our first reaction. I went to the church hires up, and I said, look, what am I to make of all this? These are stories. We have to take responsibility. I was told at every level of the church the exact same thing, like a lawyer had put the words in their mouth. Do not believe what the Indians are telling you. They're angry that we took their land. They're making up the stories. That was 3 years before the first lawsuit. So the United Church was free to lie about everything because they weren't in court. And I was told to shut up. And as a matter of fact, I remember a guy, Art Anderson, who was a personnel officer for the United Church. He came to me in the first 6 months I was there because I began to invite these Native people into my church. We went from 20 to 100 people in the church. And some of these Natives were getting up. I had an open pulpit policy, and they were getting up and talking. Art Anderson visited me, you know, this kind of avuncular visit. And he took me aside and he said, you know, you have a young family. These are his exact words. You have a young family to support, so I would be very careful about what you're doing right now. That's all he said.
Mm.
It was kind of like the velvet in the velvet glove over the steel fist approach, right? Like just the warning.
Right.
The warning always comes. And, of course, I didn't know what he meant, and I couldn't pull back. I knew that this was real, and I saw the effect in the community. I saw the huge rate of Native suicide, the poverty, the literally starvation going on in my own backyard. So I couldn't stop. No moral person would stop, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you, you mentioned... Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's okay. I'm glad you didn't stop. You know, it's... I'm glad you didn't. There's a testimony from one of those natives that you spoke with at the time that really stood out for me in your book, Murder by Decree. And I realized that it's one of the same people that you you spoke about also in your book, Fallen. So this is Harry Wilson.
Yeah.
And so his testimony just really stood out for me because he speaks about the abuse that he suffered in the Port Alberni residential school, but he also gave a testimony about finding a body, you know, at that time and reporting it, and nothing really seemed to be done about it, and that he was even transferred out of the school, so he wouldn't have even really known what happened while he was out of the school. And then, you know, I noticed that he... there was an article about his testimony actually in the mainstream news, and it shows you know, in that decade after you were listening to people and giving a voice, it shows you were really making an impact and creating this space for people for First Nations people to tell their stories and let the truth be told. So maybe could you take us maybe into that next decade, you know, 1992 to say 2002, when you started to really listen to these stories and put them out there, you know, what happened next in your path? And I don't know if that's exactly when connections started to happen to Europe or not, but maybe.
After that, definitely. So it was a very, very hard decade because it was so much effort to get the most minimal thing out. After, you know, the short story about all this is that for 2.5 years I carried on at Port Alberni at St. Andrew's United Church, and because I was so successful in bringing people in, the church higher-ups were watching me, but the local congregation loved what I was doing. I was filling up the church, and there were native and poor people standing alongside rich white folks, and they, you know, they really felt that there was a big change happening. Port Alberni is like a southern U.S. town that would try to get blacks and whites together in the same congregation. Whites and natives had never come together in churches before, and there it was happening in our congregation. People thought it was a miracle, and they loved it. But in October 1994, I was at a presbytery gathering of all the ministers, and I heard a story about lies being told by church officials. A guy called Oliver Howard got up and he said, well, the House of Indians want all their land back, and of course we can't give it back to them because it's owned by the church. I had just met with some of the House of Elders that they're right out on the west coast of Vancouver Island, and they had told me that they had been trying to get land back that the missionaries had stolen and then sold off to logging companies, right, for a lot of money.
Wow.
The houses had never seen a penny of it, of course. So I wrote this naive letter to the presbytery saying, hey, you know, it says according to the United Church policy, we have to take native land in our possession and give it back and not profit from stolen native land. So I just cited the church policy. I was out on my derriere within a month of writing that letter, because what I didn't know at the time was that it was part of a huge corporate acquisition. It was the biggest corporate deal in British Columbia history, where Weyerhaeuser, a big Seattle-based, is one of the largest logging companies in the world, had worked with the United Church to get this land in a deal with the British Columbia government. So I was stepping on a $1 billion-plus deal, and I didn't know it at the time. So I was removed quicker than you can imagine and blacklisted. I was told that unless I agreed to psychiatric evaluation, hence, you know, implying I was crazy, retraining, even though I had two young children to support, retraining for without pay for a year, if I didn't agree to that, I'd be defrocked immediately. And that was completely illegal under church rules. So the hammer came down immediately, and I didn't know later it was because of all this. But it was funny, after, not funny, but very indicative, that same period of time, my wife and I were penniless, so we had to move over to Vancouver. I was trying to retrain to get my PhD at the University of British Columbia. She was approached within a month of my firing, my wife, Ann McNamee. And she was told by the United Church officials that, look, he's never going to work in the province again. He's never going to get a job. If you want out, we'll help you with your divorce. That was told to her by Art Anderson, John Justman, the United Church lawyer, Foster Freed, the presbyter official. All of them sat down and told her that. And,
right.
You know, it was what you do with a whistleblower. You go to their wife, you go to the closest people to them, and turn them against them. And unfortunately, Ann agreed. And I didn't know this until divorce court world, this all came out. Lost custody of both my children, and just they came down on me like a ton of bricks. In my, you know, it was shattering my life, because what you do is you take away the livelihood and the family of a man, and he usually collapses, or a woman. And at the same time, it was going down to the healing centers, because all of this hidden hand was at work. The first Native survivors of these residential school death camps were beginning to gather and tell their stories, and I went down there. And I began to share with them evidence that I had accumulated. And I, you know, that took us off on the next stage, which led to that meeting that you referred to at the beginning in 1998, mm-hmm. where we held the first forum in Canada ever about the residential schools. And murders, sterilization programs, all of that stuff began to be mentioned for the first time.
Right. It was a huge turning point when that was, put into the mainstream media and people were really waking up to what was going on. And I just want to acknowledge, you know, the suffering that you went through at that time. And, you know, it shows a lot of strength in your character that you had the integrity to stand up for what you believed in. And, you know, I'm sorry for your loss during that time, but really grateful that you had steadfastness and, you know, continued to persevere through that. It's pretty incredible.
Well, I had to. You know, I really had to. And I remember, realizing that, one day I've got to face my children. I've got to be able to look them in the eyes. I've got to be able to face those who depended on me. And I was mm-hmm. responsible. My culture had done this crime. You know, part of the smear campaign that was put up by the RCMP, and it's been active for many years over the internet, has been that, well, Kevin's trying to speak for Native people. And from the very beginning, I was addressing my own culture. I said, like a man has to address rape, mm-hmm. white people have to address the genocide. We caused it. It was our invention. It came out of Europe. It hit us, though we're in Europe as well. You know, it came from a source in Rome eventually, if you trace it back, but we're all complicit in it. So I had to take responsibility, and I just thought it was the act of what anyone with a conscience would do.
Right. That's where there's some commonality in our path, because I had to face similar types of choices and make similar decisions on my path, you know, the more that I was learning and discovering and I also faced persecution in certain ways, but the story isn't mine to tell at the moment, but I acknowledge the commonality there. So you were really facing resistance kind of from every side in Canada, and, at one point you realized that this is not a Canadian issue, that this is connected. You started to mention, the genocide has roots in Europe. And did you want to speak a little bit more about that connection?
Yep, there's one final piece in that. The kind of the linking piece occurred in 1998, the same year of that meeting. We invited in a United Nations group called IRAM. We held the first public tribunal into the residential schools, June 1998. In the east side of Vancouver, and there were UN observers there. There was indigenous representatives from all over North America came and heard the evidence. They filed a report. The United Nations buried it, of course. They never acted on it under pressure from the Canadian government. And then the blacklisting came in, and the bribes started coming in. The government set up what they called the Aboriginal Healing Fund, which was mm-hmm. money that any Native survivor of these death camps could get, but as long as they signed off legal action against the church and government. So it was used as a hush fund, really, to control people.
Right.
And the Assembly of First Nations, the government puppet chiefs, they all got on board with it. That's when the first smear campaigns began. But I counteracted. You know, whenever I face this stuff, my reaction as kind of a born writer is to start writing books about it. So that's mm-hmm. when I wrote Hidden from History, The Canadian Holocaust. It was my first book right after that. And it was one of 12 that I eventually wrote. And that really began to get international attention. And after we forced, we began to up the ante. Like our native groups in Vancouver that were working with me, we had a whole network of mostly poor homeless natives who were working with me, who weren't part of the government bought Indian network, you know, in the government system, yeah. Of the tribal councils and that. These poor native folks were going around with me and others to churches. We started protesting outside, and then we peacefully started occupying these churches during their services. That created mm-hmm. shockwaves. In Winnipeg, Toronto, and Vancouver, we began to do that. And it began to get national headlines in 2007, 2008. And we released our film, documentary film, Unrepentant, in 2007. That got seen by a Native member of Parliament called Gary Marasty. He stood up in Parliament after watching our film and said, when are these children going to get a proper burial? That same week, the Harper government announces they were going to hold a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. So that's really the lever that got it all going. And after that, Canada was forced to issue this so-called apology, but then they started engaged in a major cover-up, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was designed to conceal the evidence, silence witnesses, and exonerate all the churches and government. They've never done any time. They've never gone to trial for any of this. That's what these so-called public inquiries do. And being blocked in that sense, that's when I went international, and I began to get invitations after the success of what we're doing, forcing that out. I began to get invitations from Ireland, England especially, of survivors of mostly the Catholic Church who wanted to take the same kind of action, and that's when we, in 2010, we formed the International Tribunal in Crimes of Church and State.
I see. You know, there's a metaphor that came to mind as you were sharing all of that. You know, it's really, it's quite complex, and it's quite, you know, there's a lot of details and a lot of things that happened all within a short period of time. But it reminds me of, you know, if there's domestic abuse in a home, then people in the home try to, you know, the adults in the home will try to keep it a secret, you know, can silence it, and they tell the children how to behave and what to say and what not to say, and they cover it up so that their neighbors can't tell that there's abuse in the home.
Right. Yep.
And if the children grow up and start to talk about it, then, you know, it starts to really shake things up. And sometimes there'll be a kind neighbor or an understanding neighbor or someone in the community that understands and believes and reaches out and, you know, can help to make some change for those children or start to make an impact on the family. So that metaphor came to mind when you're talking about how Canada responded to this. It's, you know, once they started to silence you and to have these cover-ups and deception and public spinning and all that sort of thing, you're getting invitations outside of Canada because these are like the neighbors that are seeing the truth of what's going on and giving you, it sort of gave you the way to expand and to grow, because outside of Canada, it was easier for people to believe you because it wasn't in their own backyard.
Exactly. And that's a brilliant metaphor because it's exactly that situation. Nobody can look at the crimes within their own family, their own nation. There's just this huge denial. Like what I often hear from white Canadians is, okay, we know now the children died, but not all the churches were bad. They really had good motives, didn't they? Well, I mean, you know, it's that same thing of, well, if we're nice to the father or the mother, they're not going to beat us so much. You know, that whole notion.
That's true.
You know, it's the attitude of a crushed personality as opposed to somebody who's reclaimed their own identity and say, no, it's all wrong when that happens, and I can stand on my own identity. I'm not asking for justice for anyone. I'm reclaiming that. And that's what's the success of what we're doing. We never asked for anything. We said this system is fundamentally wrong. If it allows us to go on, the courts are complicit. We need a new system in place. And that's one of the reasons we set up the International Common Law Court of Justice and said ultimately citizens have the right, when the courts and the governments and every institution is involved in genocidal crimes and ongoing crimes against children, we have the right to convene our own courts, make our own citizen arrests, reclaim our communities for the sake of our children. So that's really what inspired that whole common law court movement out of the tribunal.
Right. Makes sense. You can see you can see how can see a lot of things. There's so many things I want to say right now, and I don't know which one to choose.
Well, anyone is fine. That's what's good about a dialogue.
Sure.
Go for it.
Sure. Well, you know, when we're just talking about the tribunal, and it just leads me to be thinking about how important the solution here is about self-governance and how the tribunal really helps people to be, in the growth that we are achieving through this awareness, we're reclaiming our minds, we're reclaiming our culture, our own sense of being a human being. And there's a fundamental truth about us being equal, you know, and equality between men and women, equality between every race. And what I see from the tribunal is that this is a way that our rights can be truly honored. And I see the wisdom in having a court system that's set up outside of the court system that's already established, because we can't fix what's there. We sort of have to let that crumble. And then if we really want to move forward towards this peaceful civilization that we're envisioning, we really need something altogether different. We need to build something brand new.
Right, exactly.
So that's sort of where I'm coming from. But if you could fill in the details or just sort of expand on that.
Yeah, that's very important, because it's true that the status quo generally is always doing everything on their own terms. It's kind of like an energy system where you have to hand over your energy to a system in order to get a few crumbs back from it. But in so doing that, you're actually making the situation worse. Like in Canada, the Crown ruled very early on that they would not allow any claim of genocide into the Canadian courts. That happened in British Columbia and Alberta and Nova Scotia in the Supreme Courts there.
Really?
We tried. The thing is, we went through the legal route for a number of years. I remember this classic example of it. Harry Wilson, who you mentioned earlier, he and his cousin mm-hmm. Dennis Talio had both found bodies of murdered children on the grounds of the Alberni Residential School. And by reporting that, they were then put in the psychiatric unit in the Nanaimo Indian Hospital, where they were then experimented on to try to make them forget what they had found. Electric shocks, drugs, the whole bit during the 1960s and 70s. And Harry and Dennis both had that in their court statement. They went to their lawyer, Dave Patterson. He was going to bring their case in the BC Supreme Court. I look at their court statement, and any reference to a dead child has been removed. And we went to him, and Dave Patterson, we said, why have you taken out the statement about finding dead children? When you're 8 years old and you find a corpse, that's pretty traumatic. That's a factor in rewarding compensation, right? And here's a quote from the lawyer. I am an officer of the court, and there's some issues I'm not allowed to raise. And I said, like the criminal culpability of the Crown for murder, and he wouldn't answer me. So obviously these lawyers, in Crown lawyers, they take an oath of loyalty to the very genocidal institution we're putting on trial. So naturally mm-hmm. you cannot get justice in a system like that. You need to have what never exists in Canada, and that's the rule of law. Like, in theory, in the United States, where the people, and the founding fathers of America were very clear about this, the people have to have control of the courts through the jury system. The grand jury and the common law jury system, they formulate the law. A judge does not have the right in America, in theory, to do what they can do all the time in Canada, which is rewrite court records, dismiss cases, intimidate witnesses. That's just, you know, the old monarchical system of operating. And so we're really standing on tradition. It's not particularly radical. We're just reclaiming that whole common law tradition.
It makes sense.
Well, you know, and it's also the only way to get, I mean, the number of people I've worked with who've gone through the system, it's so rigged, it's so designed to crush people, you know, to get the maximum $10,000 for a lifetime of suffering. That's all you're allowed in the so-called reconciliation program. They gave any survivor $10,000 if they could prove they suffered these things. So I've been to these sessions that, you know, you have to sit in front of lawyers for the church who are trying to break you. They're saying, no, your father raped you at 3. That's why you suffered, isn't it? Nothing happened in the church. They did everything possible to break these people, and then they have a thing called the meat chart. The lawyers rank points. Like if you're anally raped, you get 5 points. If you're friendly raped, you get 10 points. Count up the points and then give you money. They give you money and then you sign off any legal action. So what you're doing by that is you're becoming shamed and humiliated again. You're saying, I sold out my whole story for a few bucks. And
oh my gosh.
It's designed to crush people again, and it's evil. It's so destructive, and that's what they call justice in Canada.
I wasn't aware. I wasn't aware that's what they were going through.
Oh, constantly. And then now, if you speak, I mean, I know people in the downtown east side of Vancouver now, this whole nonsense, you know, they used to call it truth and reconciliation. They've dropped the truth word. All you see now is reconciliation, which is the, they used to call it assimilation or civilizing the savage. Now, no one is allowed to speak against reconciliation because you're causing division, you see. Nobody, it's another psychological weapon to keep everybody quiet and accept everything that's gone on. I said at a forum once, how does reconciliation help 50,000 dead children or the people being trafficked today or the people losing their land to big multinationals? It's nonsense. It's a way for the perpetrators to feel good about themselves and keep everything the same. And so this is a reality we face, and unfortunately all the Native leadership is on board with this nonsense.
I'm speechless. It's really, it's shocking to really get a grasp on, you know, what the challenges that are there. Maybe, you know, what can you give some highlights as to some of the lessons that you learned through that, or what were some of the sort of victories when you went through all that time of crisis?
There's a lot of victories. And you know, the beautiful thing about these victories, Rachel, they weren't the result of a government grant. They weren't the result of somebody coming in and giving us a lot of media attention or help. It was created from the bottom up. And this is what's so especially miraculous about it. And the way I hold up the reason I wrote the book Fallen is I wanted to hold up these four, you know, frontline guys. They were just homeless folks in Vancouver who suffered horribly, somehow found their voice and created, you know, the pressure to bring this out. And the reason they did is, and here's an important lesson, that Sun Tzu in The Art of War says all the time, it doesn't matter how big you are, what your forces are. If your finger is on the strategic heart of an enemy, if you're threatening what they love, they have to respond. It doesn't matter even if you're one person. It's your consistency, your pressure, and where you are strategically. And that's, we found when we started occupying those churches, they panicked because we were threatening the two things that churches and any corporation operate by, their public image and their money. And if you threaten either one of those, you've got them in the corner. And we proved that in practice. So that was a miracle to see it unfold and what we've created, even though now the government and others are claiming credit for it. Like, oh, it's because we decided to be nice to Indians all of a sudden. No, it's because of that direct grassroots pressure. And so I say to people, we always have to keep that up. Because it doesn't matter how abused you've been, how poor you are, any one of us has the power to choose. Will I cooperate in this evil or will I do something about it? We all have that God-given power. And it's the recovery of that power. It was what's beautiful, just another little anecdote about William Coombs, one of the guys who I wrote about. He couldn't walk anywhere near a Catholic church. He couldn't even see a cross without getting physically ill because they used to stretch him on a rack at the Kamloops Catholic Residential School, where he saw those 10 children abducted by Queen Elizabeth, never seen again.
Right.
Brother Murphy and the other Catholic priest would put him on a rack and sodomize him every night and use electric shock on him. He saw a crucifix above him, and he couldn't even see a cross without getting ill. The day we occupied Holy Rosary Cathedral in 2008, he was there with us, walking through the church with a big smile on his face. And I thought, how the hell can William do this? And he's handing out flyers to people, talking to the people. And he wasn't afraid of these priests who were livid at what we were doing, of course. And I asked him why, you know, like, how were you able to do that? He said, I didn't want to let you guys down. I saw you going to the church. I didn't want to be left out. I couldn't let you down. And it was that higher loyalty, right?
Mm-hmm.
That higher loyalty. We're doing this together. And he saw above his own pain. He had that higher fixed point where he had forgotten about himself, and he was living for others and for the cause. And that's what lifts us all up. And that's the miracle. And believe it or not, he stopped drinking for a few weeks after that, for the first time in like 20 or more years. Because he had that inner light. He had recovered his manhood and his ability to act, to do something.
Yeah. That's a powerful story.
Oh, my God. I get tears every time I tell that story.
Yeah, it's powerful.
Yeah.
Well, when you're talking about the grassroots pressure, you know, and what an impact that makes, so I thought maybe we can explore that a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because I think that you said when you were occupying churches, you branched out into Toronto and Ontario at that time. Is that right?
Yeah, we had groups there. People I'd known in my, like, I had done a lot of lecturing across the country, and I would make contacts and form groups in different country, in different cities. And okay. Winnipeg and Toronto, we had groups. They were called Friends and Relatives of the Disappeared were the groups, and they conducted the church actions. Yeah.
Okay. And then is that what brought the awareness of Mush Hole and the situation in Brantford?
Yeah.
Or how did that come into your radar?
Well, after we formed the tribunal, there was a group of 10 Mohawk elders in Brantford, Ontario. It was the site of the oldest Indian school in Canada, the Mohawk Institute, set up at the Church of England in the 1830s. And they invited me in. They said, look, we know there's a mass grave of children right there. We know eyewitnesses saw the burials happening. We'd like you to come in and get some technically competent people, do a ground survey, find out where these graves are. We want these children brought home for a proper burial. We want forensic analysis done to find out how they died. They were taking the bull by the horns. Now, these Mohawk elders had had a history of action. They were the ones doing the land reclamation, stopping the destruction of their land in the area given to them traditionally around Hamilton, between Hamilton and London. It was called the Haldimand Tract. And they had already had that long experience of going up against the government. So they invited me in. Bill and Cheryl Squire, other Mohawk elders invited me in. And it was classic what happened. We found evidence. We went in there with trained archaeologists, a forensic specialist. We did the ground-penetrating radar survey. We did several excavations and found bones that the Smithsonian Institute in Washington confirmed. Don Ortner, the pathologist there, said 90% certain it was bones of a young female that we had found, charred, burned, and cut up, but definitely the remains. School uniform buttons tangled in the roots of trees. Because they would always bury trees over the graves of the children to conceal them. All of that came down, and then the government moved in, shut it down, started an enormous smear campaign that you'll still see up on the Internet, making it look like the Mohawks never supported us. They bought off or scared off all the elders. But in the wake of that, we took that evidence, we took it to Europe, and it was a big part of the evidence that actually in 2013 convicted Pope Benedict, forced his resignation and three other cardinals because of their direct involvement in not only that crime, but in you know, authorizing child trafficking all over the world. That was the first common law court case that a lot of people have heard about.
Right. That's quite a victory.
Oh, my God. It was amazing. I mean, the very fact that, you know, well, we had, the good thing about that, Rachel, was that the Spanish government had looked at our evidence. And for people listening, if you want to bring a human rights case, go to the Spanish government because they claim universal jurisdiction over any human rights matter. You can try it in a Spanish court. We worked with several judges there, and they issued, 5 days before Pope Benedict resigned on February 11th, 2013, the Spanish government issued a diplomatic note to the cardinal, who also resigned, Bertone. He stepped down. And the diplomatic note said if the Pope comes to Spain, he might be liable for arrest because of the evidence we've seen in the common law court docket. So it shows that any court can act on these common law verdicts. It gives incredible power. If you can make a Pope in Rome step down, the sky's the limit, people, right? We can act on this. And this is a lot of the work I've done since then, training people how to do that and take action in their own communities.
Right. Could you share more about that? The sort of the grassroots efforts and training, and what's the solution for today?
Well, yeah, it's in the books, especially the common law training manual, which you can see at Amazon.com. It's called Establishing the Reign of Natural Liberty, a common law training manual. And it gives you the steps, not only the philosophy and the legitimation behind why you can do this, but the steps to employ in creating a what's called a court of record, with a jury. It's a jury-based court. The right of citizen prosecutors to try cases, to establish citizen sheriffs in your community to serve the warrants, to make the arrests. But it's a big step because it means taking power back into your own hands. It means regaining your own mind. And we go around conducting those training workshops, not just on the issue of child abuse. Like, for example, last year we were in Sacramento California working with a group that wanted to stop the smart meters. Child trafficking is a big issue we hear about, but corruption in the courts, police harassment, tax fraud. I mean, all of this is, you know, in other words, crimes by the state, the church, the corporate sector.
Yes.
That's what we hear again and again from people. So I see a real awakening happening and a willingness for people to take that next step and say, yeah, we are the power. We can reclaim. We not only can, but we have to reclaim that power now, you know, if we want a future for our kids.
Right. Well, what you're saying there, it's reminding me of something that you wrote in the book. You've got your book called Truth Teller's Shield, A Manual for Whistleblowers and Hellraisers.
Yeah.
And there's one section you say here where you're just talking about the importance of learning to be alone and finding your new family. And, you know, you mentioned that there's illusions that we have that we think that I'll read what you wrote here, if you don't mind.
Please.
One of the habitual illusions that even the most hardened truth tellers experience is the lingering belief that one day the world will rally to the truth and they will be vindicated and welcomed back in from the cold. But the truth is bitterly different. In practice, whistleblowers invariably end up in a form of permanent exile from their former life. Learning to be alone to that degree is never easy for most of us, since we've been taught to look for some ultimate affirmation from society as a whole. Frankly, you can't forget about that ever happening once you go up against powerful enemies. But on the other hand, new life always emerges from the ashes of before. In the course of your long struggles, you will encounter a new kind of family, people much like you, but often so hardened by their long night that they are unable to any longer reach out and find community of like-minded souls. People you never suspect will also appear from out of nowhere to offer you help and support. In these small ways, you will learn to endure.
Right.
So, yeah, I really like what you wrote there, because I think that if there's any pattern that I see among whistleblowers and truth tellers is that when persecution comes, you know, you learn to think for yourself and you learn to seek out the truth for yourself, and you realize there's a new way of being, and sort of this new family kind of emerges from, you know, from out of the ashes, a new self and a new way of looking at things. And
I
like what you wrote there. It's very inspiring. I wondered if you wanted to elaborate a little bit.
Well, it's like a lot of this is biographical, because that's a lesson I had to learn. And it's really part of a transformation. You see, we're not into healing or restoring the old. We're into transformation, which is that in the course of getting attacked and battered, you realize, well, this is to break away ties to something old so that something new can begin. And I'm glad I'm not part of the system, either, you know, by my association or by the way I think. I'm glad I'm breaking away from it, because there's something new emerging, and I would not be able to receive that new if I was still attached in some way to the old. So I do think that there's a reason for our suffering. It's to prepare us for something better and something...
Right.
You know, that we can't recognize till we go through the suffering. So what I often say to people is, you cannot give up hope. You cannot give up. Native people were telling me that all the time. You can't give up, Kevin. We can't do it for ourselves right now, but you've got to keep doing this, because it's more, they didn't even give a reason, but now I think I see why. Because, and the voices of my own ancestors, like Peter Ann and others, were talking to me at the time. Not like I was hearing voices, but in my heart, saying...
Yes.
There's something epic going on here, because as there's centuries and centuries of this, millennia of this, genocide and suffering and degradation of humanity, it's now time for that to end, and there's a shift happening. But it's being created by us and the way we're transformed in the course of our own struggles. So that's, I think, the hidden jewel in all of this that we keep uncovering all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that really is. It's a hidden jewel. I like that statement.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a matter of encouraging each other and not giving up. If you do something once or 10 times, system can co-opt it. But if you're persistent, you're one person, you are a threat, and they will take notice of it, because not even so much as what we're doing, but the example we're being for other people. They do not want others to be inspired by our example, so they have to lie about us, they have to smear us, they have to do everything possible to get people who are afraid of who we are, you know, so they won't copy us.
Yeah, we've tried, you know, in the past 45 minutes or so, you know, we've looked over, we've tried to summarize 25 years into just a few short minutes, you know, but you've really done an excellent job with highlighting some key moments, and personally, but also, you know, politically and very publicly. You know, and you've really shared some of the major crises and losses. You know, was there anything that I didn't ask that you wanted to add, or things that you wanted to touch on?
I got an email now from a listener who says, "Please have her back on next week. This is brilliant. I want to hear more." So I guess that's a formal invitation. Let's carry it on next
week. Thank you. Thank you.
I'm very impressed too by your how clearly you get things, Rachel, and your presence online. So I think it would be great if we did this again next week. But I'm all aware at a really personal level of the worst thing that can happen to us is just passing. I used to, in my dark moments, I used to feel that because of all the lies being said about me and the fact that I couldn't see my kids very often because of the stupid court order and the other attacks, I wanted my children not to be hurt by this stuff. And so in a way, I kept them isolated. I didn't tell them everything. Now, they're amazing women. They're amazingly strong and women because of the way I persisted, because of them as well, their inherent greatness, you know, that I've seen in them. But Claire, my eldest, is a midwife now. She's 28. Eleanor, my younger, is up fighting forest fires in the British Columbia now as part of the Red Cross, where she's organizing disaster relief. I mean, you know, chip off the old block, but she has to be in there fighting all the time to help people. I realize now if we stand in who we are, even though we think we're losing our children in the short run, it doesn't happen. You stay true, and I, you know, I'm sure you as a mother can speak to this too. You stay true with your children, and they will come back. Even though it looks like the relationships are being harmed, the lies are being told, you know, you stay true to who you are, and they'll stay true to who they are.
Yes. That's so true.
Yeah,
I'm glad to hear that your daughters are happy and well, and that the relationship is strong. That's great.
Well,
to hear.
it is strong because I know that they knew. I remember when Eleanor was in London a few years ago, she wrote me and she said on Father's Day, and she said, "I know, Dad, that you always worry that you weren't there enough for us. But the fact that you were there all the time in your poverty, it made it all the more special for Claire and I. And we love you so much for it." You know, so I mean, when you have that, you're able to die happy, right? Knowing you've done the right thing. And I compare other relatives I have and how they have not stood by their own integrity, and they're lost souls. You know, they may have a lot of money and everything. They may have a lot of worldly success, but they look aged and depleted. And at least I didn't go through that. At least I held on to myself. And that's what we can all do. It doesn't matter what our circumstance or level of abuse in our life, we're not disabled when we stay true to our own hearts. So, and we know what's right, you know, and act on it. So anyway, that's maybe that's a good way to sign off, because it's 5 minutes too. And I want to end on Farewell to the Crown, which I think is an appropriate song. And Rachel, thank you for your brilliant interview and very heartfelt questions. And please come back next week, and we'll carry this on. And ask listeners to send in questions they might have about this 25-year struggle and where we go from here and what things we're facing now that we need to help each other with. Do you have anything you want to say?
That sounds great.
Anything else you want to say before you sign off?
Oh, no. I just want to say thank you so much for the opportunity, and I look forward to more.
Okay, sister. And for the listeners, murderbydecree.com, itccs.org, write to us, republicofkanata@gmail.com. Carry it on, brothers and sisters. We'll be back next week. Please tune in again. Thank you.